I'm going to start the questioning here while we're doing a little collecting of questions from all of you. And if you haven't gotten your questions in, please do right away. I think a lot of people, despite the sort of long-term optimism that you've expressed and the way in which you think we can move forward, are still wondering, well, what's going to happen in the next couple of years? Yep. And they're particularly wondering about the Affordable Care Act. And we read sometimes that our current president is trying to undermine the Affordable Care Act, having failed to repeal and replace, to go at it in a little more indirect way. Mm-hmm. And there are various things that have happened recently that give people some concerns along those lines. Could you just talk a little bit about whether you're optimistic or pessimistic about the future of the Affordable Care Act as it exists right now? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, first of all, you're raising that concern is very, very valid. There are a number of, I think, court cases and other things, direction to administration staff in the Health and Human Services Department not to do certain things to the minimum. Court cases, the elimination of the mandate, whilst I have mixed views about the mandate, was certainly an attempt to do that. There are certainly people, and on the conservative side of the spectrum, who believe that if you can't win the argument in the ballot box and you can't win the argument in the legislature, then you should try to wreck the programs. I totally disagree with that view. I'm a conservative, feel that the right way, if you are a conservative and want to see the Affordable Care Act change, is to use the very legislation itself to begin to move in a different direction. I argued for that before Trump was elected. But you're quite right that there are enormous dangers. I think, and it depends on what specific danger is valid, becomes valid over time. I think we're at the stage in the rollout and the implementation of the Affordable Care Act that it will broadly withstand those kinds of attacks. That's my belief. A number of states are using either their flexibility or just developing new steps to try to compensate for things like the mandate elimination. I think steps like that are happening. And I think, but it is a judgment call, that this particular program is at the stage where it can be sustaining sufficiently for the future. But as I said, at the same time that this is happening from the administration, there are lots of other people, Republicans and Democrats, people around the states, different think tanks and so on, are all trying to work with this existing system and so on. So I'm relatively optimistic that the next 2 years, or 2 or 3 years, as I said, I'm a historian, I think in decades, right? So I do think over the longer term, as I tried to say, that we should be optimistic about our ability to find common ground and to work in this area.
Okay, we've got several questions from the audience here, and not surprisingly, they want to know what you see as the advantages and the disadvantages of going towards a single-payer type plan.
Well, I lived under a single-payer system for the first 30 years of my life. We never had to worry about the cost of healthcare. What we had to worry about was the availability of healthcare. I think there are certain myths associated with the idea of a single-payer system. And let me just draw a distinction here. If by single-payer you mean you have a system where basically all the money going into that system comes through taxes or some direct payment, and Medicare, in a way, is like that. That's one approach. And I think within that, there can be conservative structures and so on. You can have a single form of funding. The issue is, do you organize the whole delivery of healthcare in a single way? I think that would be a disaster. I think we do not know what the right way is to organize healthcare in this country. We think we do, we try things, and so on. That's why I support the idea of having variation. I don't think the government employing all the people in the healthcare system is a really wise thing to do. If you want to have a healthcare system which every part of it is going to be dependent upon what the budget of the federal government is or the states, and you're going to be dependent on that, you're very welcome. But I think it would turn out a lot differently than you think.
Okay, we have a bunch of questions about drug prices. Okay. And a bunch of questions about drug prices and pharmaceutical companies and what's happening to the cost of drugs. And do you have some thoughts about how to deal with that?
It's a complicated issue. Because what do we want? We want to have a society where when we get ill, when we suffer or our family suffers from certain medical conditions, we want a drug industry to figure this out and to provide us with an inexpensive drug that solves the problem. To be able to do that, we have to have a lot of investment in the creation of new drugs. So generally, there is this challenge, this tension between investment and the cost, the ability to recoup the investments in the drug area. We also have another issue in this country, as you, I think most of us know, that other countries purchase drugs made by US companies, drug companies, at a lower price than we pay. As an economist, I look at this and I say, oh, this is what we call differential pricing. This is like airlines. You know, you go onto an airline, get onto a plane, everybody's paying a different amount. So what do? Do you force everybody to come up to the same level? What do? I do think that we clearly are paying more. I think the idea that if we simply allowed complete reimportation of drugs, which a lot of people do from Canada and elsewhere, you actually would not make, at least the evidence I've seen, would not make a huge difference in that area. I do think, and I agree, that there are some people, and we as a society should and do, I think, believe this, that have a certain medical condition. If we feel that those people should have affordable access to adequate health care, it does mean making sure they can afford the drugs that they need. And I do think that that does require an expenditure and a negotiation with the drug companies. This administration, like other administrations, particularly Republican administrations, has really resisted the idea of negotiation between drug companies and the government over the pricing of system. There are good arguments to resist that, because once the government gets into the business of setting prices, all kinds of issues can occur. But I think to some extent we need more of that than we currently have.
Okay, that segues into what is probably a very big question here and goes back to the emphasis you placed on, if we can agree on goals, then maybe we can find our way to think about how we get there. So the question is, can a conservative support the proposition that in a nation with a $17 trillion economy, no one should be denied health care independent of their ability to pay?
Yes. What's the next question? yes. And as I certainly alluded to, when we started off, as I said at the very beginning of the talk, and getting very liberal, very conservative people together, that was one of the first things we all agreed on. In this country, given our wealth, given our values, that everybody should be able to have affordable access to adequate health care. Again, as I did also say, as I said, not just as a conservative, I think anybody, I mean, there's a debate about what is adequate, what is affordable compared with spending on education or spending on other things. So we do have to debate that. And I think as a society, that is a problem. And every other country does that. The UK debates in its free national health service, how much should we spend on healthcare compared with other things? So the idea that the commitment to affordable access and so on means unlimited budgets and take money from everything else, I don't think that follows at all. So as a conservative, I definitely don't agree that healthcare should absorb every dollar. But I do agree that we are a rich, civilized society, and that means we should and do and must make a commitment to adequate care for everybody.
So that leads into still another question that several people have raised, which is, one of the reasons we have a high cost system is because we don't do the things we should be doing. We engage in high risk activities, we eat the wrong foods, we don't exercise enough, you know, the list goes on. And we've got some thoughts about whether we need to be more paternalistic in those areas, or is it just a matter of educating people better, yeah. or should we, you know, have the financial system
right.
vary in some way with people's yep. behavior, et cetera?
Absolutely. It's a corollary, in a sense, to what I was saying about there's more to health than medical care, saying we do know there's all these factors. Well, if there are all these factors, shouldn't we be encouraging people? You know, if everybody came to Colorado and went hiking and bicycling, we wouldn't have a problem. But too many people in New York, right? I think it is, and it's not unique to healthcare. It's also a factor in other things that we make decisions about. That if we as a society say, we the society shall make a commitment to your ability to get adequate healthcare, there's a reverse commitment. We expect you, if we're going to make that commitment to you, to make a commitment to the rest of society. That doesn't necessarily mean you've all got to live the same time of life. It doesn't mean that you must change to red wine if you like white wine because it's healthier for you. It doesn't mean that, but it does mean, as you said, Belle, that there's a certain amount of nudging and incentives that we've got to look at. And again, in all these debates, there's lines, aren't there? I mean, how much should you push somebody to take the steps needed to be healthy and to protect their lives? The debate over work requirements and so on is related to that, saying, well, we want to force people to get back into the workforce, not to take things unnecessarily, and so on. It's a difficult issue. We know that in healthcare, there are propensities. Some people are more likely, have a greater propensity to engage in certain kind, to be, you know, more overweight. Some people are more overweight because they eat too much. Some people are predisposed. Should you financially penalize somebody who's predisposed to an illness? Maybe if they can do something about it, we should. And we do that, of course, to some degree. We do it in lots of other areas. So I think it's part of the ongoing conversation that we should be having, that it's a two-way street. We had the same debate in welfare. Welfare was not considered a one-way street. It wasn't just that if you were poor, you got help. There was something expected in return. Take steps to become more independent. I think we should discuss that in healthcare, but it's a very complicated issue.
I think it'd be useful if you have any thoughts or comments on what some of the states are doing now. Mm-hmm. I think many of us who live here in Colorado have been impressed with some of the experimentation that's been going on here. Mm-hmm. And I know our former director of healthcare, who's a well-known resident of Steamboat, right. and who's here, Sue Birch, where are you? Tried to make a lot of innovations here in the state. So any thoughts on states that have stuck out in your mind as doing interesting stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think
stuff?
Colorado is a very important state in that regard, as I mentioned, that one of the things in Colorado is not only this connection between health care and non-medical features and assuring there's some connection between that, and they're done in unison, but as you well know, one of the things about Bell that you ought to know, that Bell and her colleagues at Brookings and the Urban Institute and elsewhere have developed this model called the social genome model, which says what needs to happen essentially in your life for you to do well over time. What does the research say? Things like, don't get pregnant too early, you know? All these sorts of things, which Bell can tell you about. But a number of these are medical related, and I know here in Colorado that Sue and others have been trying to put into place, how do we connect healthcare, social services, not just only to healthcare, to good healthcare outcomes, but to a good progress through life, through doing well over time. I think that's been really interesting. I think, you know, we've certainly seen other states, Massachusetts was a leader, as you mentioned earlier, in terms of trying to move towards universal coverage of various forms. Other states are experimenting, and appropriately so, I think, with things we need to think through about healthcare in this country. So states like Arkansas and others are looking at, and have been looking at, how do you look at Medicaid and other parts of the healthcare system, and really try to, in a sense, to try to make it as seamless as possible in terms of variations of that kind. There's a lot going on. I think I'm really seeing a bubbling up of states. I do see certain patterns, and a lot of those are reflective of this administration. As I said, when it's an administration gives a green light to a particular approach, you're going to see more states doing that. But I think states in general have been looking at each other. The National Governors Association routinely and bring states together. States are looking at each other. It's a bubbling process going on. It's really the core aspect of federalism that we're seeing in play across the country.
I have a question here about end-of-life conversations and whether we should be doing as much as we're doing at the end of life, and are some of these heroic measures part of the extra cost that we pay for healthcare in this country?
There's a lot of debate over what the last 6 months of life and these costs are as a factor in healthcare. There's quite a debate over what the numbers are. It's certainly a significant amount. We know as you get older, medical costs in general go up. We know as you get closer to the end of life, one of the snags is we don't know when the last 6 months of your life is going to be, so it's a bit hard to kind of make a hard decision. What we do know, and you referred to it, heroic medicine is often not heroic because the patient wants it to be heroic. It's heroic because the physician, the whole culture of the physician, is not to have life end. That's the oath. I mean, that's what they're trained to do. And if they don't get signals about what else to do, the default is to do everything you can to save this life. That's what we have to change, and you're absolutely right. It's got to be conversations. Jamie and myself and others have attended these death dinners. Death dinners, which sound like a pretty miserable thing, can actually be good fun, you know, I would recommend them. But a death dinner is when you get together with friends and you actually just talk about this. And there are actual, you know, procedures and advice about how to do it. And you start just saying things like, well, have you had made clear to everybody what you would like? Have you told your kids? Do they know what you would want? Most people have not had this. So, of course, unfortunately, what happens towards the end of life is often you'll have siblings arguing. That tends to happen. So doing that is really important. Encouraging people to do advanced directives. It's becoming more common, but it should be encouraged. Getting people to state clearly to their own family what they want. That's really important. To have these kinds of steps so that people know. And that the doctors, they're not then in the invidious position of having to go into default. I think the more we do that, the better. It's going to bring costs down. I don't know about how much. But it's the right thing to do. And I think it makes for a much more consciously sort of civilized society and a society that's happier to make these decisions.
This question is pretty impossible.
Okay.
But I'm sure you'll find a way to answer it. What disruptive innovations have worked in the past on a broad basis, and what do you see working in the future?
Well, I think if you look across industries, there have been a lot of very significant changes, some of which I mentioned earlier on. If you look at what's happening in higher education, I think you're seeing, it's almost like a slow moving, but a dramatic change. The online education, the fact now that you can work for Walmart or for Starbucks and get a free education. That's because of those kinds of innovations. Really quite dramatic. You tend to get disruptive innovation in those kinds of industries that haven't changed much for multiple reasons. Sometimes regulations and taxes are through that. So I do think that healthcare is really ripe for this. As I said when I was speaking, the model of healthcare hasn't really changed that much. It is big institutions with kind of networks kind of associated with them. It's big, you know, pharmaceuticals and so forth. I mean, big institutions of that kind. That really hasn't changed a lot. It is absolutely wide open to dramatic change. And I think we will see it. We've seen it, we have seen it in other industries. Think about the taxi cab business, right? Who would ever go into the taxi cab business? Talk about a radical change in an industry. That's, I think, what is going to happen. Now, if I knew what it would happen, first of all, I wouldn't tell any of you. I would go and make suitable investments. When I did that, I'd probably come and tell you. Because I want you to bid up the cost. but I actually don't know. I just suspect it's going to happen, and it's going to be probably quite dramatic and relatively sudden.
Well, we will forgive you for not being Steve Jobs. And I'm looking at this wonderful Churchill quote and thinking, I hope we don't try 100,000 things before we get it right. But I think with your help, we can get it right a little faster. So thank you very, very much.